but it was not planned this way, but I ended up starting this series on history's leading anti-Semites on, of all days, Yom HaZikaron, Israel's Memorial Day. It's a little on the nose, and it wasn't intended to be that way. Did you say man? Did you say man? Oh, Diane, I'm gonna remind you of that. Oh my, of all people. First, if anyone did not register in advance and did not register now before the class, please do see me because I want to be able to include you on the emails that I send out, both in terms of the sheets in advance of the class and in terms of the follow-up with which I send out a link to the audio recording so that if you miss a class, you can get it, or if you got here but you know you just enjoyed it so much you want to hear it again, you'll be able to download it. Please do make sure that that I have you down on the list for the class. If you received the email in advance with the source sheet, then you know you are already on the list. A lot of people did pay. Anyone who needs to, I will take care of that also afterwards. If you have a phone and you could please put it on vibrate or silent, I'd really appreciate it. Better now than later. Our topic, history's leading anti-Semites. So I mentioned when I introduced the topic at the end of last series that this is not meant to be a top 10. This is not meant to be number one, number two, number three, number four anti-Semites in Jewish history. This is also not, clearly, it's a four-week class. It is not going to be all-inclusive and comprehensive. So that I was asked a couple of minutes ago, will I be talking about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism? And that's a great topic, but no, that's not going to make it into the series. I think you probably saw the list of who I do plan to talk about. So we're going to be starting with Caliph Abd al-Mumin and the Almohads, moving from there into Martin Luther and the Reformation, from there into Empress Maria Theresa, and from there into Fyodor Dostoevsky. And what I'm trying to do speaks to the varied nature of anti-Semitism. What does anti-Semitism actually mean? So, interesting. Yet he says anti-Jewish. I mean, clearly that's not literally what it means, right? Anti-Semitism is a misnomer. Because often, right, it's actually coming from Semites who like themselves very much. Right, their issue is with us. Right, the term anti-Semitism comes from the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Yafet. We are descendants of Shem, so to be anti-Semitic is anti-Shem. But of course, Shem's family, this great clan that emerges from Noah, includes, among other people, all the Ishmaelites. Right, Esav, Amalek. If you think of some of our biblical enemies, they're all from Shem. Anti-Semitic is sort of a misnomer, and it's not a term I particularly like. On the other hand, we live in a world of language, and people communicate, and that's the term they use. And if you don't like it, you have two choices: either you become someone who rails against the jargon that people use, and no one really wants to talk to you because they know that they're in for a rant every time they use a term you don't like. Or you just go with the flow and use the term anti-Semite, even though it's not really an accurate term. Anti-Semitism, as we're using it here, the way it is popularly used, is hatred of Jews. But it has many different faces. There is the personal anti-Semitism, where somebody is antagonistic because they hate our presumed traits. When you look at Dostoevsky early in his career, which I hope to do, you see that. This tremendous animosity for Jews expressed in terms of the type of people Jews are, or are assumed to be. Jealousy of success. Animosity towards Jews because Jews have a sense that they are special. It's a fascinating quote in the Talmud. What's the name of the mountain where the Jews received the Torah?
Sinai.
What's the other name of the mountain? Horev. right? It's called Chorev in the Torah, but then it's also called Sinai. And the Talmud is bothered by the fact that you have multiple names for this mountain. And it offers a very interesting explanation for the name Sinai. For the Hebrew speakers, the word sin'ah in Hebrew means hatred. So if you take a look at source number one, passage out of the Talmud asks, what is the meaning of Mount Sinai? Why do you have multiple names for this mountain? For hatred, sin'ah descended to the nations of the world there. Now there are a couple of different ways you could read that line. Right? In the Hebrew, it's Sheyardas Sin'ah Le'umot Ha'olam. You could read that as hatred for the nations of the world or hatred from the nations of the world. It's legitimate as a translation either way, but the way that it's often taken and the way that I'm taking it here is that that's the place where enmity originates, in the sense that we are set apart and different. We hold ourselves to be members of a covenant with God, and even though it is true that from Judaism's perspective, anybody can convert in, it's not racially oriented. It's something that you opt into the covenant, and then you're part of, so to speak, the club. Nonetheless, the use of the phrase, the chosen people, conveys an attitude. And there are people who, this comes as a shock, I know, don't like that. They don't like the sense that Jews might have that we are special. Dahlia.
Most people, when I think about the Shevetish, the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, they weren't intelligent enough to know this. I mean, this is really...
I'm not so sure I would agree with that. Keep in mind, when you talk about Dark Ages, Middle Ages, a lot of the anti-Semitism that certainly Ashkenazi Jews are most familiar with is church-driven. And the church is very familiar. The priests of that time were better educated in Judaism than most Jews today. And I realize that's a very strong statement, but it's 100% true. They read Torah in the original Hebrew. They didn't, you know, do translations. They were pretty well versed. They didn't like us. They warped our ideas. But they knew the concept of being a chosen people. Absolutely. Yes, Diane. Yes, from a literal perspective, the answer is that you have different names because you're dealing with a place which exists within overlapping geographic regions. And that's the simple explanation. Yeah.
Sinai is with a samer, and Sinai is with a shin.
Correct. However, first of all, it's only meant to be a play on words. But second, sin and samach interchange quite a bit within the context of the Torah. So, for example, the word sota is often spelled with a samach. However, when it's introduced as a verb in the Torah, ki tiste isho, it's actually with a sin. So the sin and the samach do interchange. Something which is very worth discussing in terms of Semitic languages, but we're not doing it right now. Stephen, and then I'm going to go further.
What descended was a man with laws, and that's what descended. And it's not the hatred of the people, it's the hatred of the rules that were imposed now on society.
So that's a good segue. It brings me to the second type of anti-Semitism, which is philosophical. So sometimes this philosophical anti-Semitism comes from commitment to a religion that teaches that we, the Jews, are wrong. Wrong, benighted, evil, killed their God, you know, and so forth. When we talk about Luther, we'll see that. When we talk about Caliph Abd al-Mumin, we'll see that as well. Sometimes it's philosophical in the sense of opposition to our ideals. We're not going to be talking about Nietzsche in the series, at least not directly. But the idea that Jews brought guilt to the world and brought a conscience in a negative sense is something that we see there. Dostoevsky, later in his career, gets into that kind of philosophical anti-Semitism. Ruth.
Feeling that Paul created Christianity to be easier for people to adapt it. It was Judaism, but then he made it you don't have to worry about kashrut and so on and so forth, because it was easier for people to join.
Right. I mean, there's the whole Paul versus James split in terms of, are we preaching to the Jews or are we preaching to the pagans? And there is definitely that aspect of trying to make it more appealing in order to get to the Jews, while at the same time being antagonistic to the Jews and therefore making it attractive as a way to flee from persecution. Also true. Not really going to go into Christian marketing much, though. The third piece of this is political anti-Semitism. And when I say political anti-Semitism, that can mean a lot of different things. But the most basic early on were political alliances which thrived based on a common enemy, or in which political weight was brought to bear in order to gain strength against the Jews. The best example of that is probably the way that the popes navigated the European relations, in which there were loads of monarchs in Europe, in the Middle Ages in particular, who really not only had nothing against Jews, but had allies who were Jewish, saw Jews as valuable citizens in their lands, and the Pope said, well, either you impose the Inquisition or something like it, depending on your era in history, or I'm going to excommunicate you. James of Aragon is one of the best examples of this. The Jews suffer at his hand at the end of the 13th century, even though he's not personally, it seems, an enemy of the Jews, but the Pope pressures him, and that sets up the debate of Nachmanides. There's in 1263, that whole story comes from papal pressure, because the monarchs needed the church. Also, sometimes it's political because there's fear of the Jews in terms of fear of sabotage. A sense that the Jews are not going to be loyal to their empire, and therefore they have to suspect the Jews. We're going to see that in terms of the Almoravids and the Almohads as part of our discussion today, I expect. And yes, once you mention political anti-Semitism, I will throw in the anti-Zionism anti-Semitism, which is to say anti-Semitism that masquerades as something political when it's actually something else. But that's really its own discussion. So looking at how broad the field of anti-Semitism is, and I have no doubt that you could probably come up with some others that I didn't just mention among the motivations and drives for it, but you realize how hard it is to come up with a list of leading anti-Semites. But what I'm trying to do instead is to go for people who represent specific movements or specific issues, so that with the caliph, I'm going to be looking at religious persecution that came from Islam as one in particular. With Luther, we're going to talk about Christianity. With Maria Theresa, we're going to talk about European royalty. I have to say, that's been the hardest one for me to prepare, because I can't wrap my head around all the different monarchs and all their different wars. I never really understood just how much the world was at a state of war until you hit, the late 20th century and realize how different our world is today. But like, they're not happy unless they're invading someplace else. Like, you get up in the morning and you say, okay, where am I going to invade today? I was not as aware as I unfortunately now am. And then Fyodor Dostoevsky, the creative arts, and its own question that it raises, which I really want to get to in that subject, which is the question of how do we as Jews deal with creativity, the arts, fueled by somebody who had such hatred of Jews, the old Richard Wagner.
Yeah.
Right? Question. The question that you have to ask in terms of reading Dostoevsky, and not just Dostoevsky, I mean, it's a lot of the Russian writers of his day. But let's talk Caliph Abd al-Mumin, and the questions I want to address are, number one, how was his anti-Semitism manifest? What drove it? And how did Jews respond to it? That's what I want to look at. But it's going to take us a long time to get there, because there's a lot of background information. Out of curiosity, do we have anyone who has already, like, strong background in sort of North African, in general, North African politics, society, and so on from the 10th, 11th, 12th century? Okay, so I can say whatever I want. Good. No. All right. So, by way of introduction, we need to meet Morocco, And a lot of this, unfortunately, is going to be me talking, which is boring, but it's the way it goes, just because there's a lot of information that's necessary in order to set the stage. And we need to know about Morocco, because the Almohads, as well as the Almoravids before them, emerged from the Berber tribes, who are based in basically Northwest Africa, and Morocco today's Morocco as a prime location. So, a little bit of history then. Rome conquers the western part of North Africa in 146 before the Common Era. The Roman ruins are still found today. Their presence there fades, as the Roman Empire fades in general. The Vandals take it over in the year 429, Common Era. Muhammad begins in Mecca and Medina in the 620. We're fast-forwarding, obviously, through a lot. But over the rest of the 7th century, the Muslim Arabs spread west across North Africa and around the Mediterranean, such that there's a caliphate called the Umayyad Caliphate that controls all of North Africa and invades Europe. They controlled the Berber tribes. The Berber tribes are not Arab. They are native to Western North Africa, as opposed to the Arabs who are off to the east. I was going to put a map on the sheet, and I completely forgot to do so. I apologize, because that would have helped. This is the spread of Islam. Via the Umayyad Caliphate, it spreads early on. You're talking 7th century. It's really just several decades after Muhammad's initial revelation, so to speak, that Islam has now spread throughout that region. But the Berbers are, again, not Arab. And they are not happy with being controlled by Arab tribes. They had their own way, and we'll talk more about that in just a moment. But they throw off the Umayyads in the 8th century, and local Berber tribes take back control of their own fate, but they are now Muslim. They had all sorts of little tribal religions until then, but now they have become Muslim, and even though they threw off the caliphate, they retain their Muslim identity. I'm not going to go in the ins and outs of who ruled and when. There are Abbasids, there are Fatimids. The bottom line is that by early 11th century, the Berber tribes in the region of what is today Morocco are independent. For anyone who would like a little bit of help in terms of the map, and again, I apologize because the map was really supposed to be here. I think when I send out the follow-up email, I'm also going to send a map if I can find a good, helpful one. I don't know why I forgot to put it on the sheet, but I did. But if you can picture for yourself the Mediterranean, so in the western part of the Mediterranean on the European side, on the northern part, right, you have Spain and Portugal. So where Spain juts south, the Iberian Peninsula, that point where it juts south, you have the Straits of Gibraltar, and on the other side, on the south, that's Morocco. That's what you're talking about. And that's the region that we're concerned about, is the Moroccan region south of what would be, you know, Spain and Portugal on the northern side. And I'm really proud of myself, because I'm an American and I don't know geography, but I learned it. In Canada, Dial, you can learn. So the Berber areas are marked as apart largely because of topography, because of the type of land they had, and because of the geographic features that mark them as separate. You have this very fertile land on the Atlantic coast. The climate in that area is actually Mediterranean. It's not African. If you go south, though, off of the coast, you hit the Sahara Desert. So what you have in that region are nomadic tribes who are sort of desert, but sort of not, in addition to those who are farming the area on the coast. And then the eastern end of this is demarcated by, bless you, a series of mountain ranges called the Atlas Mountains. There's the High Atlas, there's the Low Atlas, there's the Anti-Atlas. They're all Atlas Mountains. For our purposes, what it means is you are protected from standard invasion because you have this big desert to your south, you have the water to your west. This, you do get invaded from the Straits of Gibraltar, or you invade that way, depending on who is in control and when. Invasions run north-south, but no one's going east over those mountains without facing significant risk. So, therefore, this area is really well-protected and develops on its own. And this land is what's going to produce the Almohads. Of course, this is a period when the Muslims and Christians are at war. This period that we're talking about is going to be the heart of the Crusades. And the Berbers have a reputation as really good fighters, so that they get brought into the wars as mercenaries. They're brought in to support different forces. That's something that's a little bit to know about Morocco and the Berbers. Sorry?
For which side of this?
Usually the Muslims, but not exclusively. You pay well, they'll fight. That's part one of the introduction. Part two, Jews and Muslims right before the arrival of the Almohads. So, the state of affairs for Jews in Muslim lands in the 10th and 11th century. So, Jews arrived in Western North Africa along with the destruction of the first temple, and then in greater numbers the destruction of the second temple. Standard historians say the first temple is destroyed in the year 586 before the Common Era. Jewish tradition has it a little bit later. The second temple is agreed to have been destroyed the year either 68 Common Era, the year 70 Common Era, with some debate on that score, but that's when it happens. And Jews are exiled throughout the Roman Empire, including North Africa. Then again, they flee Spain in the 7th century. The Jews are fleeing at that point from the Visigoths. And there are actually stories of Berber tribes adopting Judaism. That there were Berbers who became Jewish as a culture. Fascinating idea. Jews at that point in history have a central religious authority called the Gaon. There were various yeshivot. There were academies in key places within the Muslim empires, meaning the Jews would tend to put their religious centers near the centers of the caliphate of that time, because those would be areas of trade, those would be areas of transportation, those would be areas with financial opportunity. So you had these academies, and the head of the yeshiva, the head of the academy, was called a gaon. Today, the word gaon in modern Hebrew means what?
Genius.
That's not what it originally meant. The word gaon originally meant powerful person. Somebody with, literally, power. Ga'ava is often used in a negative term, as a negative term in Hebrew, as a term for arrogance, but really at its core, it just means power, one who is lofty. If you think of the song the Jews sang at the sea, after they got out of Egypt and the sea was split, Ashir al Hashem ki ga'o ga'a, I will sing to God because he is exalted, he is elevated, he is lofty. So Gaon meant somebody of power. When Jews anywhere had a religious question, they wrote away to the Gaon. However, with the shift of the political tides and the fall of one caliphate, the rise of another one, the academies run into trouble. And the power within the Jewish world shifts, interestingly, from the former Babylonian Empire, often what is today Iraq, shifts much more towards Tunisia, towards North Africa. There was a big community in Kairouan in Tunisia. There are Jewish leaders in Morocco. Rabbi Yitzhak Al-Fassi may be the most famous of the time. Al-Fassi means... Oh, come on. Al-Fassi from Fez. Rabbi Yitzhak of Fez. I actually was wondering, we love our acronyms in Judaism, and so you have like Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki becomes Rashi, Rabbi Moses Ben Maimon becomes Rambam, Rabbi Yitzhak Al-Fassi becomes Rif, where he should become Riaf Al-Fassi. And in fact, in earlier texts, you find him sometimes written that way. In the Hebrew, Resh Yud Aleph Pei, Riaf. But it stops, and I wonder if it isn't because there's a Moroccan mountain range called the Rif Mountains. And I wondered, I'm not kidding, I wonder if they, not that the mountains were named for him, but I wonder if they gave him that name because he was associated with the Moroccan Jewish community. But in any case, it's a bit of a digression. The Jews at this point are very vulnerable. Before even you get to the Almohads, there was a massacre of 6,000 Jews in Fez in 1033 by a Berber tribe called the Zenata Berbers. So Jews, on the one hand, are developing their religious centers and trying to have communication among the various scattered Jewish communities. And on the other hand, they're very vulnerable at this point. This is all North Africa. Let's go across the Straits of Gibraltar into Spain, or as it was often called at the time, Andalusia, or Andalusia. So the Muslim Empire, the Umayyad Empire, has broken down by the time you hit the 11th century, and it's broken down into independent Muslim-controlled communities called Taifas. I'm not 100% sure I'm pronouncing that right. Does anybody know? Ah, then I am. It's spelled T-A-apostrophe-I-F-A, and that's the way I keep pronouncing it as I read it. But this introduces us to a very interesting controversy called the convivencia. Controversy. The idea of convivencia is that at this point in history, people got along. You've heard this idea. It's about the early golden age of Spain. The idea that Jews, Christians, and Muslims thrived under Muslim control back in the day. That it was a period of intellectual curiosity, it was a period of artistic development, it was a period of greater freedoms, and that the Muslim leadership at the time were very tolerant. And this is an idea which historians have promoted, promoted, the period about 100 years ago. This was a very popular idea. The Berbers were seen as a very positive part of this. There are particular Jewish figures who rise in the government of the sort of sub-empires in the Muslim lands of that time. One of the most famous, if not the most famous, was Shmuel HaNagid, Shmuel the leader, who actually was the leader of the military for one of the most powerful taifas of the time. Chazda ibn Shafrut was another. However, this idea of convivencia, that everybody just got along, and yes, it's true, Jews and Christians had dhimmi status, which we're going to talk about more, under the Muslim leaders of the time, that idea that everybody just sort of sang kumbaya and has come under fire from historians as just being more or less a fantasy. It may be true that there were times when specific Jews did okay, and there were times when we were not being massacred. And, you know, if that's your barometer for, you know, things being good, you know, we live to see the next day, then I guess, yeah, you can call it convivencia if you like. But the facts are a lot harsher in terms of how this worked and in terms of what dhimmi status meant. And I'm going to come back to dhimmi status. I'm not leaving that. It's very important for us to talk about. Yes?
If I may.
Please.
But surely the Arabs needed the Jews. Well, number one, so say they exploited the Jewish network around the Mediterranean. Yes.
Yes.
You could perhaps comment on that later. Number two, when they did invade, they needed educated, literate, and numerate people to administer as they went north.
Right. So Bernie makes an important point, which is that absolutely there were practical considerations when people dealt with the Jews, meaning that those who may not, yes, still true, those who may not have liked us did not have the liberty to get rid of us. And in particular, during the Crusades, when the Christians and the Muslims, not in this area, not in the North Africa area, but further in Europe and other areas around the Mediterranean, are not speaking to each other, right? They're busy fighting, and they need people to trade with. And in particular, they need money. This, of course, will come back with Dostoevsky. But they need money. And keep in mind that Islam and Christianity adopted what the Torah says regarding lending and charging interest. Meaning, the Torah tells you that you are not allowed to charge interest from your brethren when you lend them money. Christians wouldn't charge interest to Christians. Muslims wouldn't charge interest to Muslims. And what happens when you can't charge interest? Then you don't lend money. Right? That's the way it works. Right? There's a term. There's a term financially. It's a fancy economic term for an interest-free loan. It's called suicide. Because your best possible conclusion, is that you, the lender, lost your opportunity cost, and that's all you lost because you got paid back on time. That's your best possible conclusion. Your more realistic conclusion is that there is inflation, that the money that you lent out is no longer worth what you lent out, that you don't get paid back on time, that you have to take the person to court or go after them in order to get paid back, and you may not get paid back at all. Interest-free loans are, from a financial perspective, a bad idea. The Torah frames them as tzedakah, as charity. Don't expect that you're going to make money on this. You will lose money, but you're doing it in order to provide capital for farmers, to provide capital for businesses. That's the way it works, which is why you end up ultimately with workarounds within Judaism, ways that you can make an investment and it's not a loan, and that way you'll get proceeds from the investment, because otherwise you end up with the credit freeze that we had in North America in the economy going back, whatever it was, 10, 15 years ago, the credit crisis where people would not extend loans. That's what you end up with. Your economy freezes. Well, now imagine that you have not the small little Jewish nation that's not extending interest-free loans, but instead these big Christian empires and these big Muslim empires, and they can't do it. They need to get capital from somewhere. And Jews come in. Yes, the Jews who couldn't own land and who couldn't do all sorts of other things, but they are able to provide capital. And so to a certain extent, there is a necessity for them to have us around. And that's part of how we survive. This is certainly true. And yes, there's more to be said about that. When we get to Maria Theresa, we may have more of a conversation about the role that Jews played. Think of the Oppenheimer family. There's a lot to be said. Yes, there was a hand somewhere.
Yeah. Just very quickly. So you would say that the anti-Semitism at that point is coming from the Pope, the Church?
Not in the Muslim lands. They didn't care much about the Pope. The Pope in the Christian lands is very papally driven.
So the period you're talking about right now, which one would it be? 1, 2, or 3?
So right now, so what you're seeing at that point among the different kinds is largely the personal philosophical as opposed to the political. The political becomes more important as we move into the next phase that we're about to address, which is the rise of the Almoravid, call them a dynasty, an empire. They didn't last long enough to be a dynasty. They're at 70-something years. So you can't really call them a dynasty. They're a couple of generations. But going back to the 1030s, roughly, there's a Berber by the name of Yahya ibn Ibrahim. And he goes looking for a religious teacher. He is from the Gudala tribe of Berbers. This will not be on the exam, don't worry. There's a Gudala tribe of Berbers, and he goes looking for a religious teacher to teach them Islam. And he finds a fellow named Abd Allah ibn Yasin. Well, this fellow, Ibn Yasin, is very charismatic and very influential. And Ibn Ibrahim is his patron. But Ibn Ibrahim dies, and Ibn Yasin becomes an ally of another tribe called the Lamtuna, also a Berber tribe, a very large Berber tribe. And they promoted an ideal of not only learning Islam themselves, but also going to war against others who don't believe properly. It's not enough that we want to learn Islam, but anybody, including Muslims, who don't practice the Islam that we believe in, they are the enemy. And we need to make sure that they are either converted to our belief or defeated. And their motivation is religious, but their motivation is also economic. In the sense that, while it's true that the mountains, the Atlas Mountains, are protecting you to your east, and the Sahara Desert is protecting you to your south, financially, you're trapped. What are you going to do? You're going to survive off of the traders who are working their way through the Sahara? It's not great. And even the Atlantic trade, there are others who are larger and doing better in terms of the trade. They want to get beyond basic survival in the Sahara. And I saw a great line, I don't remember where I saw it, and I wish I could remember which book I saw it in, but they said, the reason why they were able to thrive and to get beyond this is because they saw the Sahara not as an obstacle, but as a highway. Meaning, if you saw the Sahara as an obstacle, you were never going to get beyond where you were. If you see it as a highway, meaning you know the routes to get through it and to get out to the other side, then you are able to bring goods that others outside don't have access to, and you are able to get goods and bring them back and market them. And so a lot of it for them, their desire to expand, is economic. They're going to benefit from the more fertile land outside and benefit from this trade. They become known as the Almoravids, a term which is generally understood to highlight their religious identity in particular. They, if you take a look, I brought it on the sheet here in source number 2. This is from a paper by a woman by the name of Amira Benison, as well as Maria Gallego. Amira Benison is a prolific writer on this period, and her writings were very helpful to me. I'm going to be quoting her quite a bit. But he's talking here about something from the Almohad. She's talking here, I should say. I'm just trying to see, because I'm not seeing right now here what I had actually wanted, what I thought was in this source. You know what? I didn't end up bringing it, that's why. I wrote in my notes that it was here, but it's not here. I apologize, so I'll just tell it to you outside. The name Almoravid is understood to come from either the word ribat in Arabic, which is a school, word associated in Hebrew also with terms for raising children, interestingly. Or, alternatively, there's a verb that has the sounds R-V-T, which refers to a tie to God, a connection to God. They were known for the being severe adherents of Islam, as opposed to the Muslim rulers they replaced, who they said were materialistic, were self-serving, taxed people unfairly, made deals with Christian monarchs. And the Almoravids bring in Sunni judges. For those who are familiar with Sunni versus Shia in Islam, they brought in these Sunni Muslims who applied religious law to the areas that they conquered, and their method was to appeal to revelation rather than reason. They weren't into the Aristotelian type of philosophy. They were into, what did Muhammad say? What are the lessons that we have? What are the practices that we have been practicing? They thrived on what's called asabiyya, which is tribal loyalty. And the fortunes of Jews and Christians under the Almoravids varied based on who the leader was. On the one hand, Jews were forced to wear garb that marked them as dhimmi. And again, we're coming back to what dhimmi is. But those dhimmi rules also served to protect them, as we will see. There was a Muslim historian in the 14th century by the name of Ibn Khaldun who made an observation regarding the Almoravids and this era in Muslim history, but it applies beyond that as well. Talked about the way that tribal movements, and particularly religious tribal movements, evolve. And he said they succeed in the beginning because they come from the desert, a harsh land where they learn unity, they learn to rely on each other, they're very austere, they're not exposed to luxury, they're not looking for luxury, they have the set of ideals that they're all devoted to and this common loyalty. But then they evolve, they enter urban areas, they settle down. They lose their special character, their loyalty to each other. They become loyal to what they've built up instead, to the wealth that they've developed. And so they start to senesce. They start to lose that which made them very sharp. And the result of that is that they become vulnerable to the next invader to come out of the desert. And that's what happens with the Almoravids. They become vulnerable to the Almohads, which finally is going to bring us to the story of the Almohads and Caliph Abd al-Mumin. So are we sort of clear? I mean, the high points that I want to make sure we get, are the isolation of Western North Africa and the Berber areas, because that's key to generating this empire, as well as the fact that Islam has spread throughout the area. Jews have fared in mixed ways until this point, largely depending on who the local leader was, as well as pragmatic concerns. The Almoravids are the ones who are in charge right before we start this Almohad period. They came in as severe enforcers of Islam, as opposed to those who had preceded them, who they viewed as more materialistic. And now in come the Almohads. They're founded by somebody by the name of Muhammad ibn Tumart. He was a Berber of the Masmuda tribe who was known as a kid for being very studious. And he sets out on a journey to gain knowledge across North Africa as well as Andalusia up into Spain somewhere around the year 1106. At the time, there's a controversial theologian by the name of Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali is considered one of the great thinkers in Sunni Islam. He was very against Aristotle. He published a book called The Incoherence of the Philosophers. He believed in revelation, he believed in spirituality, and Ibn Tumart becomes a student of his thought. Within traditional Almohad belief, he actually met Al-Ghazali. Unclear whether that meeting ever happened, but as the story goes, Al-Ghazali hears that a certain Sunni judge has ordered the burning of one of his key books. And he says to Ibn Tumart, "I want you to go to war against the Almoravids." Well, Ibn Tumart travels throughout North Africa, preaching greater Muslim education, preaching religiosity, criticizing the Malachite judges, these Sunni judges of the Almoravids. And of course, what happens is he gets thrown out of communities as a result. But that doesn't deter him. That doesn't stop him. Take a look at number two, please. That's the paragraph that I was starting before. Al-Baydaq is a biographer of Ibn Tumart. But he's contemporary to him. He's not someone coming in later on. So his eyewitness account of this part of Ibn Tumart's life suggests that he began this journey as a reformist preacher and only gradually developed his religio-political mission to overthrow the Almoravids. He also used his time in Algeria, he, Ibn Tumart, to create a small cohort of followers who then accompanied him west, the most important of whom was Abd al-Mumin, a Kumia Berber tribesman from the Tlemcen area who ultimately succeeded Ibn Tumart as head of the Almohad movement and constructed the Almohad Empire. Sorry, Muhammad, what? Oh, okay. Yeah, we're still number two. During the journey to Marrakesh, Ibn Tumart gained stature as a gifted preacher with an uncompromising message that God's uniqueness was the central tenet of the faith and that true adherence to him required total submission to the way of life detailed in the Quran and the Sunnah. By the way, as we read through the sources that I've brought here, you will find the transliterations change. We're talking about the same people, but their names are not English. And so trying to put them into English results in characters that some fonts don't have, and just people spell them differently, and so we just have to deal with that and try to keep up. He, Ibn Tumart, was highly critical of customary practices not rooted in these sources, meaning the Quran and the teachings, the early teachings, of jurists' lack of knowledge of them, and the emulative rather than rational critical tendency predominant among Maghribi scholars. The Maghreb is the western part of North Africa, right? The word in Hebrew is what?
Ma'arav.
Right, Ma'arav, the ayin being originally a guttural, Ma'arav, Maghreb, it's the same term. But Ibn Tumart is critical of the way that the judges there are ignorant, he believes, of the real sources of tradition, and they're ignorant of analysis of that tradition. They're just doing what others had done before them. They were emulative. He had a puritanical stand and reacted strongly, sometimes violently, to men and women mixing in public, to wine drinking, and to music and dancing. But aside from this, his extant works show that he was also an erudite scholar, able to use philosophical and logical arguments to press his point home and impress and silence the Maghribi jurists and students with whom he debated. So this is somebody who wants rigid Islam to be applied, and he criticizes the Almoravids for not following that model. In number two, I brought you more from Benison, from her book, The Almoravid and Almohad Empires. I'm not going to read it out in the interest of time, but it's more of the same in terms of what he believes they're doing wrong. The one thing I will actually jump to in number three, take a look towards the end of the source. When it says, middle of the source, the last word on the line is the word when. When he, Ibn Tumart, reached Marrakesh, the charge that Ibn Tumart made against the Almoravids was precisely that they were too ignorant and dependent on Maliki jurists, those judges, to provide adequate religious leadership for their subjects. The confrontation between Ibn Tumart and the Almoravids began in the great mosque of Marrakesh, where he publicly criticized the Almoravid ruler Ibn al-Yusuf for wearing the traditional male face veil of the Sanhaja and for sitting on a rich silk cloak in the mosque. And what happened was the Almoravids wore veils, the men. Where he was coming from in the east, that was a no-no. The women wore veils. The men didn't wear veils. However, for tribes that come out of the desert, It makes a lot more sense to wear the veil as a protective. And so the Amoravids wore it. And he said, your men look like women to me. That was the big criticism that he was lodging. As well as sitting on a rich silk cloak in the mosque. And as the story is told in Almohad sources, he criticizes this Almoravid leader. And the Almoravid leader says, you know, you're right. I've been doing it wrong. Because that's the Almohad telling the story. History is written by the victor. While these criticisms may seem obscure to us, they were gauged to highlight Almoravid customs which other Muslims found strange, and also suggest Ali's ignorance of Islamic religious norms. So that's what Ibn Tumart is trying to challenge. Ultimately, though, Ibn Tumart is not only about bashing the Almoravids. He proclaims himself to be the Mahdi. As I brought here in number 4 from Benison, there is a belief in Islam that there will be a Mahdi. Mahdi, more or less, is their analog to what we call Mashiach. He's supposed to be a messianic figure who is going to bring people to true religion. And it happens to be a good time to make a claim like that, because it's the early 12th century, and as Benison notes, you're hitting the year 500 in the count of Islam soon, and there was a belief, we like large round numbers, it's a human thing. Base 10 is a big deal for us. So there's a belief that the year 500 is coming, it will be a messianic time, and he plays up the traits that he has, that he believes, identify him as the Mahdi. That is this fellow Ibn Tumart. But Ibn Tumart is not our focus. Our focus is his student we've already referenced, this fellow Abd al-Mumin. Abd al-Mumin is a student of Islam. He joins Ibn Tumart during his travels through North Africa. Historians say he was really not an exceptional person physically. He was of medium height, dark hair like most would have been there. Good soldier, gifted orator, he spoke well. In the year 1130 or thereabouts, Ibn Tumart is killed in battle. His students keep it secret for 3 years. However, they make, well, that's not so strange. 900 years later, it's still going on, right? Where they don't know whether this leader of Al-Qaeda or this leader of whichever movement is still alive or not alive. They hide it because they don't want word to get out. And in particular, what they don't want is a battle of succession. They're waiting for somebody who is, so to speak, the next in line to reach a point where he will have the confidence of everybody and then they will proclaim him. And that's what happens with Abd al-Mumin. He is considered a senior student of Ibn Tumart. He establishes himself as the spokesman of Ibn Tumart, who of course is dead and therefore isn't speaking much. But Abd al-Mumin is, you know, generating the material anyway. There's also a fear because he's from the wrong tribe. He's not from the Masmuda, and a lot of the followers at the time were Masmuda, a fear he won't be accepted. Ultimately, though, he emerges, announces Ibn Tumart is dead, and he leads them into war in two different directions. Heading east across North Africa, and he goes beyond where the Almoravids had been before, extending east and up into Andalusia, up into Spain. He wasn't so eager to fight in Spain. He really focused more on North Africa, but his followers extended further into Spain. He declared himself the Caliph. Caliph, Caliph. You'd say one way, you say it the other way. Tomato, tomato. He is a warrior. He is a religious leader. He's not a thinker. Ibn Tumart was the thinker. He published. The Abd al-Mumin does not publish anything about his beliefs, anything about his ideas. What did the Almohads believe? So the name Almohad comes from the word Tawhid, which comes from a word that you will know in Hebrew as Yachid. What does Yachid mean in Hebrew? Sorry? One. Single. Unity. It's the belief in one God. And his argument is that the others who he is supplanting have stopped believing in the one God. They believe in either literally idolatry, they believe in multiple gods, or what they believe is closer to a Christian trinity. And he says, no, we believe in only one God. He, unlike Ibn Tumart, argues for the use of logic, not only revelation and precedent, in order to arrive at law. If you take a look at source number 5, this is an article on Almohad ideology and the Rihla of Ibn Jubair. Ibn Jubair is a traveler. Rihla is a journey in order to acquire knowledge. And it's a travelogue that he wrote. And and this essay in particular is about the worldview of Tawhid. So take a look. The Rihla of Ibn Jubair achieved its popularity because it represented a vision of Islamic society where the worldly and otherworldly spheres, increasingly separated in reality since the decline of an earlier caliphate, were again united by the agency of pious Muslim leaders after the model of the Almohads and through them by God. This was the sociological embodiment of Tawhid, which said that nothing exists outside of God. All the power in the universe, all the physical and moral laws by which it is regulated reflect the same ultimate reality, God. In other words, what the Almohads preach is that it's all about God. Whatever we are doing in our empire, wherever we are going, whatever we are conquering, it is all of God. We continue on the next page. Ibn Tumart's interpretation of Tawhid, the most fundamental feature of monotheistic Islam, must largely be gleaned from a collection of texts written down in 1183. During the reign of the second Umayyad Caliph, Yusuf ibn Abd al-Mumin, meaning it's Abd al-Mumin's son, what is revealed is that Ibn Tumar took the radical approach of claiming that knowledge of God and His oneness can be known by reason or logic through the wide testimony of His acts from the aspect of the necessity of created things for a creator, the necessity of the existence of a creator. I bring you a lot of text here, not in the interest of boring you, but in the interest of hopefully you having reading material that can supplement what we're saying here in order to get a better grasp of it. But they're very into the idea that there is one God, only one God, all loyalty is that one God, and anybody who doesn't believe firmly in this rigid view is worthless, is not to be supported, not even to be allowed to survive. They also were heavily anti-materialism and heavily into austerity. And now that brings us finally to a discussion of anti-Semitism, because at some point we did have to come to that. The treatment of Jews and Christians as well in the Almohad Empire. So that, we have to go back to this Dhimmi idea. So Dhimmi is actually designated and designed as a term of protection. It refers to minorities who do not come from Muslim traditions, have not accepted Islam, live in Muslim lands, and on the one hand, they are to be treated in a way that identifies them clearly as a sub-people, not only a minority, but as people who are not as good as the majority. But on the other hand, they are not to be attacked, they're not to be killed, they're not to be harmed, as long as they agree to live in this status within society. I brought you off of Wikipedia because it was actually a very good summary in their opening paragraph in their Dhimmi article in source number 6. Dhimmi is a historical term referring to non-Muslims living in an Islamic state with legal protection. The word literally means protected person, referring to the state's obligation under Sharia, Muslim law, to protect the individual's life, property, and freedom of religion in exchange. No, it's true. They're supposed to be able to practice their own beliefs in exchange for loyalty to the state, payment of the jizya tax, which complemented the zakat or obligatory alms paid by the Muslim subjects. Dhimmis were exempt from certain duties assigned specifically to Muslims, did not enjoy certain privileges and freedoms reserved for Muslims, but were otherwise equal under the laws of property, contract, and obligation. And yes, it's true, the writer of this skews it towards the positive, but it's fundamentally true to the principle of Dhimmi. Diane. Yes. I mean, the difference is that Ger Toshav, like the full term that we used for somebody who accepted Noahide laws within Judaism, had certain religious obligations, meaning they had to reject idolatry. Ger Toshav is a more demanding status in that sense. Oh, no, let me backtrack on that. I need to explain one more piece about Dhimmi before I can address the contrast in that in Ger Toshav. Dhimmi status was not for every non-Muslim. You had to be among what was called people of the book. It's very funny. People are Jews are very fond of calling themselves people of the book, but they don't recognize that actually it was Muhammad's term for us. And it wasn't just for us, it was for the Christians as well. It meant people who had the Bible, who had earlier prophets, and who had warped it such that we wouldn't accept Islam. Meaning they believed that, and still believe today in Islam, that Jews warped the text of what we call the Bible, the Pentateuch, the Chumash, so that, you know, the most famous example is at the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. They believe it wasn't Isaac, it was Ishmael. They believe that we rewrote the biblical text in order to support our narrative as the chosen people, but in fact, they are the chosen people. So we were identified for this status. Dhimmi's status was not extended to every pagan. It was specifically for the people of the book. That was the idea. Sorry? Yes. Maybe. I'm not sure what would happen to monotheists who did not accept any form of biblical text. I don't know. But Ger Toshav's status for us, the idea that in Israel, when we enter the land, if any of the people choose, they are able to accept the seven Noahide laws and live among us, gives them greater support than the Dhimmi had from society, greater rights to support, and less persecution than what a Dhimmi would have faced. So, for example, one of the classics of Christian Europe originated with Islam, the Jewish badge. Right, the idea that we had to wear special clothing that marked us as Jews was actually Muslim originally. Caliph Umar and others. And Ger Toshav did not have any requirement of having to wear special clothing. There were no limitations on what a Ger Toshav could do for a living. There were limitations on what Dhimmis could do for a living. There were limitations on what a Muslim could do for a Dhimmi. Because it would be degrading for Muslims to engage in certain trades, certain practices towards a Dhimmi. We'll see that. It's going to be next week, not this week. It's a much harsher thing than what Jews had under the Ger Toshav rules. On the other hand, the Ger Toshav rules are more demanding. In terms of demanding an acceptance of God. There are, like I said, similarities and differences. But the Dhimmi status, we still have 3 minutes. Take a look at number 7. It will actually be a pretty good introduction to it. This comes from the writings of a judge by the name of Ibn Abdun. He was actually an Amorophid judge during the times when things were a little better for Jews, as opposed to the Almohads. Take a look at this. Some of the rules, we're at number 7. Some of the rules traditionally applied to the Dhimma were intended to underline their inferiority. This is particularly obvious in the case of rules concerning dress and greeting customs. As many other Muslim jurists before him, Ibn Abdun insists on these traditions, stressing the need to prevent Christians and Jews, as well as tax collectors and policemen, from dressing in clothes that are suitable only for honorable people. He even stipulates an obligation for them to wear an external symbol or distinction to make them more immediately recognizable, with the obvious intention of humiliating them. Similarly, he forbids that they be greeted with a typical Islamic formula, Assalamu alaikum, right? Peace rest upon you. Justifying this prohibition by referring to the Quran, which implies their inclusion within, quote, Satan's party. Fun party. However, Ibn Abdun was by no means the first to identify the Dhimmis with the party of Satan. Similar precedents can be found in Islamic legal literature. One of the clearest examples of Ibn Abdun's contempt toward the protected people can be found in his identification of Jews and Christians with two undesirable and marginal groups, the sick, perhaps in reference to lepers, and the libertines. Ibn Abdun held their used clothing should not be sold without a warning to the purchaser. In keeping with this derogatory attitude, Ibn Abdun displays a keen distrust of the Dhimmis, forbidding the sale of Arabic scientific texts to Christians and Jews, with the exception of their religious authorities, stating, quote, they translate them and claim credit for themselves and their bishops for having written them. Ibn Abdun also argues for the need to prevent Jewish or Christian physicians from treating Muslims, quote, as they do not harbor good feelings toward them. Parenthetically, the same concern exists within Judaism about having idolaters treat Jewish patients, fear of what they're going to do to them under the guise of curing them. So don't think they were the only ones with this concern. But what I'm trying to show you here is that Dhimmi status, which is supposed to be protective, includes a strong derogatory element. And what we're going to see next time is that Abd al-Mumin feels Dhimmi status is too good. And he seeks to eliminate it altogether to the Jews who are under his control. And that's where he comes in as the first of our four leading anti-Semites, because of the way that Jews suffer. Because what he does, and we'll see it next time, is he says it's not enough to keep them as a minority among us following their own religion. They should have no freedom of religion. They should be compelled to choose one of three options. Convert. Die. or leave. Those are your three choices, which of course the Christians then emulate afterwards in their lands. But Abd al-Mumin is a pioneer in this regard, in this demand. So what we're going to see, God willing, next time, and it's going to take a significant chunk of next time, although we're not going to read all the text here, is to see what happens to the Jews under these Almohads in this demand, and how Maimonides responds in a way that shapes Jewish response to such demands down through the ages afterwards. So all of that, God willing, will be next time. I do hope to get some of Martin Luther next time. I don't feel bad for his sake, but we did talk about getting to four, and I'd like to get to all four in some sense. So that will be, God willing, next time. Again, if you did not receive an email for this class, meeting with the source sheet, and you didn't sign up already today, it means you're not on the email list. Please see me to make sure that you receive it. Thank you very much.